didn't exist before the old gods were imprisoned is useless on this side of the mist. This place is old school, so if you want to cook something, you do it with fire, and if you want to kill something, you do it with a pointy object. And if you want to get around, you do it on foot or on an equimaris. If you want music, in theory, you make it yourself. But be aware that I will tie you up and gag you if you do. Okay, Ducker said, drawing out the last syllable like a long musical note of uncertainty tinged with a healthy questioning of his career choice. You know this is all Tanria 101, right? Yep, Tanria 101 is now in session. Hart urged the Equimaries forward and began his apprentice's first tour of Tanria, keeping to the outer edge near the mist. Drudges could be found anywhere inside Tanria, but the border was the least likely place to come across criminals illegally mining gems or poaching exotic birds, unless they happened to catch them as they were breaking in. Today's ride would be purely educational. In short, Hart was teaching Duckers about Tanria the same way Bill had taught him all those years ago, by beginning with the basics. "We're starting with history," he said. "What is Tanria, and how did it come into existence?" "Oh my gods," Duckers rubbed his forehead in frustration. "Answer the question." "The old gods were all about war and vengeance and stuff, so the new gods overthrew them and put them in prison on Earth. That was like a couple thousand years ago. The old gods lived here until 200 and something years ago, when they finally cried uncle and the warden let them out and the unknown god made them stars on the altar of the sky. Then some guy made the portals 25 years ago and yada yada yada.
And people could get into Tanria for the first time since its creation," Hart finished for him. "I get that you're annoyed, but I want to make sure you are absolutely clear on how shit works here, because yada 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 covers a lot of territory. Like how many of the locals weren't too happy with the fact that a bunch of people started pouring into Bushong either to loot a sacred place or to profit off the adventurers and business tycoons making money in Tanria. Yada 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 also elides the fact that once people could get through the mist and die in Tanria, they could be turned into drudges, which is why the Tanrian Marshals were formed."
"Elides? Who talks like that?"
Hart pinched the bridge of his nose. "The point is, there are a lot of stupid rumors out there about Tanria, and I want you to know your facts from your fiction. Half the population of the Federated Islands believes that dragons are flying all over here and hoarding treasure."
"So, like, they're not?"
"No."
"Oh, I knew that."
"No, you didn't." It was a smug answer from a man who had thought there were dragons in Tanria when he was a kid, and had been as disappointed as Duckers was now to discover that they were nothing more than fairy tales. "Why did the new gods place Tanria in south central Bushong?" Duckers surveyed his surroundings as if the answer might be helpfully written on a nearby tree trunk. "Because it's arid and rocky and shitty, and about as far away from water as you can get. So very few people were living here at the time. I'm sorry, what were you saying about this being Tanria 101 and everyone knowing all about it?"
"I guess they didn't teach us that part in school," Duckers muttered.
"I guess they didn't. Now, tell me what you know about drudges." Duckers perked up, ready to hold forth on this subject. He'd probably played drudges and marshals a million times when he was a kid, like every other child in the Federated Islands.
"No one knows what they are or where they came from. All we know is that if someone dies on Tanrian soil, they can be infected by some sort of spirit and reanimated. Most people think they're lost souls since they infect the appendix, but since souls are invisible, there's no way to know for sure."
At that exact moment, a soul floated past Duckers, the eerie rod of amber light drifting over the pink hillocks of Tanria like a windblown dandelion seed. Not that anyone but Hart could see it, and not that anyone knew that Hart could. No one who was alive, at any rate. In the days when he and Alma were partners, he had been tempted to tell her that he could see the souls of the departed, his demigod gift. But then he'd remembered what happened to Bill, and he'd kept his mouth shut. Since Hart couldn't do anything about a soul when it was disembodied, he kept up his lesson. How do you kill a drudge? Can you kill them? Aren't they already dead? Hart opened his mouth, then closed it. Good point.
Aha! In your face. Who's educating who here?
Duckers pumped both fists into the air in triumph, a gesture he undercut a second later, when he nearly fell off the Equimaris and had to grapple for the pommel to stay on. Who's educating whom? Hart corrected him, tamping down the unfamiliar urge to laugh. How do you take out a drudge?
You poke them in the appendix so the lost soul can't stay in the body. It's like an off switch.
Is that an easy thing to do, to poke them in the appendix? Hart put air quotes around the ridiculous wording.
No?
No, it is not. The appendix is very small.
Well, let me tell you, it felt fucking huge when it blew up inside me.
Hart turned his head and pretended to cough when, in actuality, he was barking with laughter. I imagine that it did. When is a drudge most likely to kill a living person?
When the dead body they possessed is all rotting and nasty, and they need a fresh body.
Good. What happens if a drudge gets outside of Tanria?
Seriously? Does that happen?
Rarely, but it's not unheard of. Sometimes a marshal will deliver a body to an undertaker, thinking they've hit the appendix when they haven't. And if they wrap the drudge up in sailcloth so that it can't move, no one's the wiser until the undertaker unwraps it, and the drudge is free to wreak havoc in some border town. Also, a drudge sometimes manages to get through a pirated portal if the criminals using it don't seal it up properly, or if it malfunctions. It's been happening more and more lately. So, what do you do if a drudge gets out?
Pokey pokey,
answered Duckers, illustrating his meaning with his pointer finger. That's right, because a drudge will continue to decay, which means it might try to kill someone on the other side of the mist. It doesn't understand that it can't infect a body outside of Tanria. That's why you have to be certain that you've hit the appendix before you take the remains out of here for shipment home. Is that clear? Hart wanted to scare this point into his apprentice.
Yes, sir. Do drudges infect animals? Are there squirrels and shit that are drudges too?
A drudge can infect anything with an appendix.
What all has an appendix?
In Tanria? Humans, rabbits, opossums, porcupines, and graps.
And what?
Graps. Rabbits, opossums, and porcupines were already here when Tanria was created, and some of them got stuck inside. But graps were created by the old gods. They're like frogs, but they're furry. You'll only find them in Tanria.
Huh. What about cats and dogs? Do they have appendixes?
No and no.
So they don't have souls?
Hart brought his Equimaris to a halt, and Duckers' mare, sensing authority, stopped in her tracks as well. Do you honestly believe that dogs don't have souls? Have you ever met a dog who wasn't 100 times nicer than your average human being?
No?
Exactly. Don't insult dogs like that. He gave his Equimaris a light tap and got them both moving once more, feeling a bit guilty. The kid didn't know about Gracie, after all, and Hart didn't need to go chastising him on day one.
Guess you like dogs, said Duckers.
Guess I do.
Let me ask you something. If you had to choose between saving my life or saving a dog, which would you choose?
The dog.
That's funny. You're hilarious.
I'm not laughing, am I? Hart nudged his mount forward, leaving Duckers to catch up.
Dang, that's cold, sir.
Hart glanced behind him and saw his apprentice clinging for dear life to an Equimaris that had begun to trot. He faced forward again, so Duckers wouldn't see him grin.
Chapter 4. Zeddy's confession and its ramifications continued to worry Mercy the morning after her brother's disastrous first, and possibly last, day as undertaker. But since she had no ready solution and a backlog of boats to build, plus a well full of corpses to deal with, she donned her apron and rubber gloves and goggles and got to work. The body on the prep table had belonged to a licensed grap trapper whom a marshal had brought in the day before. A woman killed and reanimated by a drudge while gathering graps for the lucrative tannery and pet market. Unlike the leaky, keyless man Hart Ralston had brought in 2 days before, this one came with a prepaid funeral package from Birdsall & Son. Once Mercy had cut off the soiled clothing with a sharp pair of scissors, she bathed the body with the sink's hose attachment. Then she sang the incantations of the three fathers and the unknown god as she rubbed salt into the dead woman's already sluing skin. From water you came, and to water you shall return. You shall sail into the arms of the salt sea, and Grandfather Bones shall relieve your body of your spirit. The warden shall open the door unto you, and the unknown god shall welcome you into their home, where you shall know peace. Mercy lost herself in the verse, her alto voice filling the room. While it lacked the resonant heft of her father's baritone register, she threaded the words with her own respect and gravitas. Once the grap trapper was wrapped in fresh sailcloth, placed in her boat, a nice oak cutter, and stowed on the dock to go out for delivery, Mercy fetched the last of Birdsall's keyless indigents for the week and performed the same ritual again. As the salt did its work, she placed a generic key on a cheap chain around the unfortunate man's neck. Then she reached into the bin on the work counter and pulled out a small wooden boat the size of her palm. Pop whittled them in his spare time, tiny catboats and sloops and cutters. He had always believed that everyone should get a boat to sail the salt sea to the house of the unknown god, no matter who they were or how poor they might have been. It was this small act of kindness and decency that made Birdsall & Son a million times better than a bloodless, soulless, profit-is-everything operation like Cunningham's. She placed the wooden boat over the man's heart, straightened his key, and wrapped him tightly in clean sailcloth. She was grabbing a quick cup of coffee in the kitchenette when she heard Zeddy say, "Be right back, Pop!" He emerged from the office across the hall, closed the door, and rammed his fingers into his disheveled curls. Mercy leaned against the counter as Zeddy walked past her to pour himself a cup. He added a staggering amount of sugar and stirred it in with a vigorous clanking of the spoon against the porcelain. "That bad, huh? God's tits and testicles, Mercy. I had no idea what you've been putting up with all these years. The books are a mess, and it's not like I'm great with numbers." Mercy gave an unintentionally maniacal giggle over her mug. "Well, you're better at it than Pop. You need to sick the math teacher on him." "I know, but Lillian's hardly ever in town. And it's unfair to make her deal with the books on her time off." Their sister had once been a math teacher in Argentine, but when she fell in love with Birdsall & Son's delivery driver, Danny, she was more than happy to abandon her little shits to travel the Federated Islands of Cadmus with her husband. "Sure you wouldn't rather salt and wrap a couple more bodies with me?" Mercy offered. "Oh, math it is," Zeddy sighed, and he returned to the office, but Mercy was far from giving up hope. Once her brother saw firsthand the importance of the work she and Pop did at Birdsall & Son, he'd come around. Mercy loaded up the old auto duck with four salted and wrapped indigents and drove south on Main Street, following it as it turned into a two-lane highway. Once the paved road met gravel, she slowed down to navigate the bumps without jostling the bodies in the hold, and she took care as she made the sharp turn onto Shipyard Road. Obviously, the corpses didn't appreciate the effort, but it seemed like the decent thing to do. She parked at the pits, well away from the small but growing shipyard, where the dead of Eternity, Argentine, Mayetta, and Harrington were buried, their headstones spaced in neat rows. She wheeled each body over the uneven earth and deposited them into the open hole where the unidentified and unwanted ended up, the people who entered Tanria by any means possible to get rich or start over, only to be killed by drudges and become drudges themselves. Mercy batted away a fly as she gazed down at the unclaimed corpses that had accumulated over the course of the week. As per usual, Cunningham's unidentified remains outnumbered Birdsall & Son's by a hefty margin. The other undertaker didn't bother to shroud the indigents, which seemed offensively undignified to her. It wasn't so much that she shrank away from the decay and the maggots, from the milky eyes and open mouths, from the muscles taut with rigor mortis. Far from it. It was simply that she believed everyone deserved a ritual to usher them into the next life. And if that left no one but her to say a few words over an unmarked grave, she was more than willing to do what was good and right. She clasped her hands in front of her and gave her speech. The words varied each time, but the sentiment remained the same. I know this pit is probably not what you would have wanted for yourself, but to be honest, it's the living who care, not you, not anymore. All those folks in their fancy boats getting interred here or shipped home, they're going to the same place as you. Some of them have been preserved in Tanrian heartnut sap. Some of them will be buried in shipyards, in airtight boats that aren't supposed to leak. Some will be burned to ash in their boats and scattered on the ocean by loved ones. But in the end, they'll all sail the salt sea, like you. The warden will welcome them into the house of the unknown god, and there will be nothing left but what Grandfather Bones leaves behind. It's the way we all go. So safe travels and a happy homecoming to you. It's been a pleasure and an honor to serve you here at the end. She gave the bodies one last look, as if to say, I see you, before heading home. By the time she returned to Birdsall and Son, the delivery duck was parked by the dock, which meant that Lillian and Danny had arrived while she was out. Mercy's spirits lifted. She took a quick bath in her apartment above the boatworks, threw on one of her favorite dresses, Robin's Egg Blue, covered in pairs of cherries, and picked up a bottle of wine before heading to Pop's house with Leonard at her heels, and a renewed optimism that everything was going to work out. Her springy gait was made springier by the raucous laughter of her family, which she could hear from two doors down. She skipped up the front steps, threw open the door, and let the explosion of sound that was her family wash over her.
Is that the literal best sister ever?
Zeddie called from somewhere out of sight, as Mercy dipped fingers into the dish of salt water on the family altar and touched her mother's key.
I'm right here, you rat, Lillian fired at him, hugging Mercy hard, then dragging her by the hand to the dining room table, where they could sit and watch Danny, the one family member who could cook, make dinner in the kitchen. To Mercy's shock, Zeddie appeared to be helping him.
I am very alarmed. What is happening? Mercy asked her sister.
Do we trust Zeddie with a knife, honey? Lillian called to her husband.
Danny grinned adorably. Everything about Danny was adorable, from his dark red curls to the tips of his brogues.
He's learning to cook.
Do we trust Zeddie with food? Mercy asked.
Zeddie gave her a theatrical glower and gestured with the knife, flinging onion bits all over the floor.
Har har! Weren't you the one complaining the other night how terrible our dinners are without Danny?
No, that was you complaining. And also not cooking.
Well, now I'm learning to cook, so shut up.
Gods help us.
Mercy made a show of tiptoeing into the kitchen to grab a cracker off the cheese plate and offer it on the hearth's altar to the right of the kitchen sink.
Please make sure he doesn't poison us, she mock prayed to the kitchen god.
You're a riot.
Zeddy towed her in the butt to nudge her toward the dining room as Pop came in through the screen door in a cloud of cigar smoke. When he saw Mercy, he grimaced and tried to wave away the evidence.
Pop! Dr. Galdamez said no smoking!
He put up his hands in surrender and went into the kitchen to help himself to the cheese plate, which probably wasn't the best thing for his health either.
What are we having?
He asked.
Roasted chicken, balsamic glazed carrots, and a nice green salad.
Danny uncorked a bottle of wine and started pouring it into the glasses on the table, leaving Zeddie to his own devices.
God bless you, but isn't Zeddie going to burn down the kitchen without you?
Mercy stage whispered to her brother-in-law as he poured her a very generous glass of Pinot Grigio.
Hey,
Zeddie protested.
He's not too shabby, Danny answered with a laugh.
But as he started pouring a glass for Lillian, he pulled up short, sloshing wine onto the tablecloth.
Oh, geez, babe, can you drink this stuff?
Mercy froze, her body understanding what Danny was implying before her brain could catch up.
Of course she drinks wine. Who doesn't like wine?
An utterly clueless Zeddy commented as he peeled garlic cloves.
I like wine,
Roy added, also clueless. Lillian gave Danny a wide-eyed, exasperated look, and her husband's freckled cheeks turned pink.
Shit,
Sorry, he whispered to her.
Wait, are you?
Mercy began, but Lil pinched her leg under the table.
We'll talk later,
she said out of the corner of her mouth, releasing Mercy's poor thigh. In her mind, Mercy was dancing on the table, squealing.
Lil's having a baby!
It was all she could do to keep herself from bawling over her sister she passed her the carrots during dinner. But her joy came with a bittersweet barb after dessert, when Pop raised his glass, directed a meaningful look at Zeddy and a more pointed one at Mercy, and made the same toast he had made at Lillian's wedding.
Cheers to this wonderful family. May it continue to grow.
Oh my gods, this again? Said Zeddy.
You, you're still a baby, Pop told him. But Mercy is 30 years old. Oh boy.
Mercy put her napkin on the table in case she needed to wave it like a white flag.
I'm not going to be around forever, and I want to make sure you're taken care of when I'm dead and gone.
Lillian snorted.
Who's taking care of who here, Pop? All I'm saying is that I would like to see Mercy settled. That is such an old god's thing to say. Are you hiding an altar to the god of patriarchal order around here? Old gods, new gods. I don't care so long as I know someone is watching out for Mercy. Preferably a nice man who makes a shitload of money.
Can I get one of those too? Zeddy interjected.
If he makes a shitload of money, you can marry a whale for all I care. Pop, I'm fine.
Mercy assured him.
All in favor of moving on to a new topic of conversation, say aye.
Aye, answered Lillian, Zeddy, and Danny. Even Leonard grunted from the couch in the parlor. Did you hear the Arvonian polo team is getting a new head coach? Danny said to divert Pop's attention. Because if there was one thing Roy Birdsall loved nearly as much as his family, it was professional sea polo. Lillian nudged Mercy.
Let's escape while we can. Want to get another slice of cake? Does the mother of sorrows want a vacation? What kind of question is that?
The sisters sneaked into the kitchen as Pop declared,
I don't care how many times Red Wing has won against Vinland. They're no match for Bouchong's aquamarine front line.
Mercy cut an extra large piece for Lillian, and not because her sister was pregnant. Lil could always pack it away while maintaining the petite figure she had inherited from their mother. Mercy, on the other hand, was built like Pop, tall and big-boned. She liked her curves, but sometimes she envied Lil's size. It would be nice to find a dance partner who managed to clear the top of her head by at least an inch every now and again. Her ex-boyfriend Nathan had claimed that he was 6 feet tall on the nose, but when they danced, she highly doubted it. The thought of Nathan jabbed her in the heart.
Sorry about Danny, Lil said, taking an enormous bite of cake and talking through the crumbs. I stopped by Dr. Galdamez's first thing after we got to town to make sure it was true. I was going to tell you after dinner, but my beloved messed up the big reveal. I'm so happy for you, Mercy told her. But while she was thrilled for Lillian and Danny, there was a part of her that was envious. She had always imagined herself settling down with someone nice and starting a family of her own, but that notion seemed to be drifting farther and farther from her grasp these days. The thought of Nathan jabbed her in the heart again. I'm trying to wrap my brain around it, Lillian said. Me? Having a kid? You'll be fantastic. Well, I had a good role model. Mom was pretty great, Mercy agreed with a fond pang of grief. Yeah, she was, but I wasn't talking about her. Mercy gaped at Lil, momentarily speechless. She sniffed, then sniffed harder. But you don't want to tell Pop yet? She asked, not quite hiding the sentimental quaver of her voice. No, it's early days yet, and I don't want him to get his hopes up in case... Well, in case. So please don't tell him. Or Zeddy. I don't trust that brat to keep his mouth shut. But I want to make sure you know, because me being Prego is about to upend how things work at the family business, and it only seems fair to give you as much warning as I can. By now, Lil had polished off her cake and was pressing her thumb against the crumbs on her plate. Mercy set down her fork and eyed her sister. Meaning what? Lillian sucked the crumbs off her thumb and wiped her hand on her skirt. I can't travel all over the islands with a baby.
And I don't want Danny leaving me on my own for days or weeks at a time to deliver bodies. What's the point of being married if we're not together? No one expects either one of you to stay on indefinitely. We can hire someone else to do the deliveries. That's not what I'm getting at. Look, Mercy, Zeddy is the undertaker now, so let him worry about hiring a new delivery driver. And let him hire a new office manager while he's at it, so you can finally get on with your life. Zeddy's secret roiled in Mercy's stomach alongside the chicken and the carrots and the salad and the second slice of cake. But if I leave now, the whole business will collapse. I'm not suggesting that you abandon Zeddy. You can help him get on his feet, but once you do, the time has come to move on. I can't. Yes, you can. Sweetie, you're so smart and talented and organized. Stop wasting yourself at Birdsall and Son. It wasn't that Mercy didn't think she was smart or talented or organized, and it wasn't that she was in love with running the office either. It was more that she couldn't imagine a career outside of Birdsall and Son and everything it stood for. Besides, how on earth was she supposed to make a fresh start at age 30 with no degree and no experience outside of managing the clerical needs of an undertaking business? What happens if Zeddy can't make a go of it? She asked, knowing that it was more than a mere possibility. Then he doesn't make a go of it, and he does something else. If worse comes to worst, Cunninghams can handle the debt of the western border towns. Mercy gaped at her sister. Don't give me that. You're the one who got stuck with the business after Mom died, and you practically raised me and Zeddy too. Well, Zeddy and I can take care of ourselves now. You deserve to live your own life for a change. Mercy took up her fork and speared another bite of cake. But it would crush Pop if the business went under. And Cunninghams is such a soulless, inauthentic end-of-life experience. People deserve a choice. Dead people don't care. Never once has someone piped up from the hold of the delivery duck and said, "There's too much salt in here," or, "I told Enid I wanted teak." Lillian took Mercy by the arms, and Mercy couldn't help but recall that Lil had sucked the crumbs off her thumb and was now touching her with it. "Think about it. For me?" Mercy nodded, but there wasn't much conviction behind the gesture. She couldn't leave until she had convinced Zeddy to take over, and that might be a long time coming. Lillian kissed Mercy's cheek. "Good talk, but I gotta go barf." Not one, but two secrets weighed Mercy down as she walked home with Leonard, and both of them seemed to be herding her toward an uncertain future, one without Birdsall and Son. Normally, when she had a problem, she would talk it through with Lillian, but she had promised Zeddy she wouldn't say anything about his degree in ancient Midoran philosophy. And replacing Lil and Danny was now one of the many plates Mercy had to keep spinning. "Ugh," she told Leonard, as she plopped onto her settee in the apartment above Birdsall and Son, undertakers. Determined to be a lapdog, he sprawled across her legs and crushed her beneath his weight. How sad that Leonard was Mercy's sole confidant. She couldn't talk to her family about the things that worried her most. And Nathan was out of the picture. And any friends she'd had in her youth had long since left eternity for greener pastures elsewhere. How on earth had she let herself get this isolated? It was then that she remembered the strange letter she had received the day before, forgotten in her dungarees pocket in the laundry hamper. She shoved Leonard off her lap and fished it out. "Are you lonely too?" the stranger asked her in precise letters that had more corners than curves. Mercy's heart pounded in reply. She felt a jolt of understanding, a connection to the writer, like magnets set too far apart to snap together but quivering with proximity. At least she didn't think of herself as plodding through the hours as this person did, but she most certainly knew someone who goaded her like no other. The name Hart Ralston displayed itself in her mind like a garish advertisement on an oversized billboard. She stared at the signature line. A friend. Mercy loved her family more than anything in the world, but it would be nice to have someone in her life who wasn't so completely and utterly up in her business, a person who wasn't foisting secrets on her that she didn't wish to keep. In short, a friend was exactly what she needed. She knew it was absurd to write back. This person was a complete stranger, after all,
And how on earth could she send a response with any confidence that the Nimkilim could get it to the right person? She sat at her desk anyway, pulled out a sheet of stationery from the drawer, and wrote the words, "Dear Friend," at the top of the page.
Chapter 5. Mentors and apprentices were never assigned to sectors until after the first 2 weeks of training, and since they were sticking to the least populated areas of Tanria, hence the least likely places to encounter a drudge, Hart decided to make camp that night rather than stay in a barrack with other marshals. Alma had already foisted Ducker's company on him. He didn't feel a need to foist anyone else's company on himself. Ducker's was dozing off on his sleep sack, and Hart was reading his interlibrary loan, Crossroads, the Intersection of Modern Grammar and Compositional Theory, in the flickering light of the campfire, when Basarius's booming voice shouted, "Knock, knock, mail delivery." Ducker's shot to his feet and grappled for his unloaded pistol crossbow as the oversized bipedal rabbit sauntered into the campsite on two enormous feet.
"A drudge! Kill it! Kill it!" shouted Ducker's.
"How you doing?"
the rabbit greeted him, as if the kid weren't waving a weapon in his direction. Ducker's halted his frantic panic dance.
"Nimkilim?"
"No, I'm your grandma. Yes, I'm a Nimkilim. Put that thing down before you blow the asshole's balls off by accident."
"It's not loaded," Hart said blandly from his battered old folding stool, where he calmly sipped a cup of chamomile tea.
"It's a Nimkilim,"
Ducker's breathed in relief, inexplicably blocking his own crotch with both hands.
"I thought I was a goner."
"A possessed rabbit is not going to be the means of your end, Ducker's, I promise."
"What, the Rube's never seen a Nimkilim before?"
the rabbit asked.
"Our Nimkilim back home was a lizard," answered Ducker's.
"Basarius, Ducker's, Ducker's Basarius. Whatever he's got, I'm sure it's for you, kid." The Nimkilim took a letter from his pack and squinted at it.
"Nah, it's for you, sunshine."
"What?" Hart asked, incredulous. "From the chief?"
"No."
"From whom, then?" The rabbit looked at Ducker's, jerked his head toward Hart, and snorted.
"Get a load of Mr. Grammar here. From whom? How the fuck should I know who sent it?"
Hart took the proffered letter, studying one side of the envelope, and then the other, but it was completely blank. "This has no address on it, smartass."
"It was addressed by Hart, dumbass." "I am Hart." "No, Hart, with an E, like thump thump, thump thump."
The Nimkilim shook his head in exasperation for Ducker's benefit, as if to say, "Do you believe this guy?"
"I feel you, man," Ducker's agreed.
With the weight of Ducker's and the Nimkilim's eyes on him, Hart slid his finger under the envelope flap and pried it loose. He took out the letter, unfolded it, and saw the words, "Dear Friend," at the top. His eyes bulged, and his breath came in short bursts.
"What, did somebody die?"
Ducker's wondered aloud. Ignoring the question, Hart skimmed down the page and saw that it was signed, "Your Friend." He refolded it and clutched it in his hand. The rabbit was staring at him with an air of expectation, as if Hart was supposed to read the letter aloud.
"What?"
Hart demanded.
"He's waiting for his tip," Ducker's whispered.
"What? Why? No one tips me when I deliver dead bodies."
Basarius gave Ducker's another one of those what the fuck expressions.
"Don't look at me. He hasn't paid me yet either."
"Fine," Basarius grunted.
He strode to Hart's pack, which was slung over the picketed Equimaris, and began rifling through it.
"Hey,"
Hart protested. But before he could reach him, the Nimkilim had unearthed a bottle of whiskey and blown a layer of dust off it.
"This man needs help," he told Ducker's.
"Don't have to tell me twice."
"Put that back," said Hart,
but it wasn't very forceful. All he wanted was to read the letter that was practically scorching his fingertips.
"Or what? You'll kill me? I'm immortal. Grab me a glass, kid."
Ducker's handed Basarius a tin cup, and the Nimkilim shook his head in disgust.
"Guess this'll have to do."
I keep whiskey around for medicinal purposes, so don't drink it all, groused Hart. That's your problem, not mine. Bessarius poured out 3 fingers worth of whiskey, handed the cup to Duckers, then clinked the bottleneck against the tin before knocking back a few gulps straight from the bottle.
Down the hatch, kid, the rabbit said with a belch,
toasting the young marshal in training with the bottle raised high in the air. He's a minor, Hart told Bessarius. To Duckers, he said, put that down. Duckers sulked, but he did as he was told.
Cheers, said Bessarius,
and he sauntered away from the campsite, taking Hart's dusty bottle of medicinal whiskey with him. The second he was out of sight, Hart rummaged through the pack for a second lantern, trying to hide his shaking hands from his apprentice as he lit it.
What are you doing? Duckers asked.
I need to take a piss, and I'm nice enough to leave a light here with you while I'm out.
With that, Hart made his way to the nearest plausible pissing tree. He unfolded the letter and read it by the dancing light of the lantern as a soul floated between tree trunks in the distance.
Dear friend, apparently I exist because your letter has found me, although I don't know how or why. Did you really mean to chance upon me? Or are you simply sending thoughts out into the universe, hoping they find a home? In either case, please know that I am happy to be the recipient. I do indeed have that person in my life, but I can never seem to muster the meanness I require to put my nemesis in his place. How annoying. I wish I could be cutting, but I may as well try to crack a nut with a pillow. I've been thinking on your situation, vague as it is to me, and I can't help but wonder if more people are lonelier than either of us will ever know. Maybe lots of people are walking through their days, lonely as can be and believing no one understands what it's like. That's not a very cheering thought, is it? In general, I wouldn't describe myself as lonely, but lately I've been feeling isolated? Stuck? And yet, I like the things I do and the people I meet between sunrise and sunset, whereas you appear to be alone as well as lonely. They're not entirely the same thing, are they? While I am not alone, per se, there are times when I feel like I'm at a party, standing against the wall when I'd rather be dancing. Everyone else is cutting a rug, completely unaware that I'm there. Or worse, they don't want to dance with me. And I'm a pretty good dancer, let me tell you. If this letter finds its way to you, I hope it makes you feel less lonely and maybe less alone, too. In the meantime, I remain your friend.
Hart read the words again and again.
Dear friend.
He had written a letter to no one, but someone had written back, and he liked this someone. He raced to the campsite and barely remembered to slap his usual insouciance in place before stepping into the dying light of the campfire. He didn't want Duckers to know that his whole world had been changed in the course of 10 minutes. That was a long piss, the apprentice commented. He was sprawled on his sleeping bag, reading, of all things, a Gracie Goodfist comic. Hart decided not to say anything about the now empty tin cup beside him, because Hart had a letter to write and a person to whom he could write it. He tore a page from the notebook in his pack and got out a pen. Dear friend, he began, I wish I could tell you what your letter means to—
Who was that letter from?
Duckers cut into his thoughts. Hart grunted with annoyance. Whom? And none of your business.
Who are you writing to?
Still whom, and still none of your business. Do you mind?
Is she pretty?
Hart didn't answer the question, but now he wanted to know. Was she? Because he got the distinct sense that she was, in fact, a she. Something about the wording, the lovely slant of the letters themselves. Duckers shrugged and went back to reading his comic, leaving Hart in peace to read what he had already written. I wish I could tell you what your letter means to— It was too raw, too honest. He crossed it out, then crumpled the page and started over with a new sheet. But he didn't know what to say. He read the letter from his friend again,
I feel like I'm at a party, standing against the wall when I'd rather be dancing.
It reminded him of his mom, of all the times she had forced him to dance with her in the parlor, with embarrassingly old-fashioned songs blaring on their gramophone. He touched her key, feeling its familiar outline beneath his shirt, where it rested against his heart on a silver chain next to his ID tag from Cunningham's.
"No son of mine is going to grow into one of those grumpy men who don't dance," she had told him.
He realized with chagrin that he had become one of those grumpy men who didn't dance. And it wasn't because he didn't like to dance. He did, actually. But he no longer had anyone to dance with. Hadn't for ages. "Dear friend," he wrote, warming to his topic, "it would surprise many people to learn that I am, in fact, an excellent dancer. If I ever find you holding up a wall at a party, I promise to dance with you." He paused. Was that flirtatious? Was he flirting? But neither of them was speaking of dancing here. This was a metaphor, and Hart was hardly likely to be found at a party anyway. Besides, this was a letter to a person he never intended to meet. That was the beauty of it. He could be completely honest with someone who would never see him, never know him in reality. There and then, he decided that he would never again cross something out or start over. He wouldn't censor himself. He would be exactly who he was. He wrote the letter and folded it into fourths, making a mental note to buy envelopes the next time he resupplied. Because there would be more letters, he was certain of it. Once the lanterns were put out, Hart lay on his back, staring at the night sky, at the stars that had once been gods. He couldn't sleep, and he didn't want to. He listened to Ducker's baby-soft snores, and in his mind, he read the words of his friend's letter over and over again. For the first time in a long, long while, he wasn't alone.
Chapter 6. It was Sorrow's Day morning, 6 days since Mercy had sent off the letter to her mysterious correspondent, but she'd had nothing in reply, and each day of her new friend's silence tied up her insides more tightly, another string that tangled itself into the knot of Birdsall and Son's impending doom. "Don't be ridiculous," she chastised herself. "You knew all along that letter would probably come to nothing." The more depressing thought was the fact that the family business seemed to be coming to nothing as well. Mercy lay in bed every night, her wheel spinning, trying to concoct ways to convince Zeddy that he could fall in love with the work. This morning, for example, she had sent him to Afton Lumber to pick up their order, hoping he would take the opportunity to walk through the lumberyard, admire the raw grain of each plank, smell the unique scent of pine and oak, and not mahogany. It's what she always did when she went. If nothing else, at least Zeddy's fetching the lumber order freed up her morning. She grabbed the broom from inside the hall closet, shook out the welcome mat, and swept off the front walkway as she did every Sorrow's Day morning. But she soon lost focus and gazed up and down Main Street in search of Horatio. There was no sign of the Nimkillim, so she gave up and went inside. In the boatworks, the ribs of her sloop in progress hung off the strong back jig, where she had left them yesterday. The boat was for Mr. Gower, who had been a tannery and ornithologist before a heart attack set him sailing across the salt sea. Better that than a drudge, Mercy supposed, but it was sad all the same. She remembered when he had come to Birdsall and Son about a year ago to set up transportation home to his wife, should he meet his end in Tanria. A middle-aged man with a balding pate and a thick ruddy mustache, he had pulled his pocket watch from his vest and opened it so that Mercy could see the watery portrait of his wife that he kept inside. "She's lovely," Mercy had said. "Such a nice smile." His own smile had made the ends of his excellent mustache bend upward as he stared fondly at the photograph. "I'm going to send for her as soon as I get settled." But from what Mercy could tell, he had not felt settled enough in the year that followed to send for his wife. And now Birdsall and Son would have to mail a death notice to his widow, followed by his body. She hoped this woman loved her husband as much as he seemed to have loved her. Then again, she wondered which was sadder, losing someone you truly loved, or never loving someone to begin with. It was the wife she thought of as she cut the keelson, settling into the rhythm of the saw, moving it back and forth through the wood, taking pleasure and pride in the steady cut. She would make a fine boat for Mr. Gower, and her craftsmanship would, in turn, bring comfort to his widow. She was hanging the saw on its peg when she heard Horatio's familiar clack against the front door. "I'll get it," she hollered as she hurried past the office, scolding herself for her unreasonable eagerness. She threw open the front door, and Horatio fluttered into the lobby, his lemon silk scarf billowing behind him dramatically. "Oh my, not getting enough sleep?" he inquired. "Your eyes are dreadfully puffy. Tea bags, Moppet. They work miracles." Mercy batted sawdust out of her hair self-consciously. She hadn't been sleeping well lately, but it was dispiriting to know that it showed. "This feels like money, darling, so I put it on top." The Nimkillum winked at her and patted an envelope made of creamy, expensive paper as he presented her with the mail. It was addressed to her father in looping, ostentatious script, and the return address was embossed on the flap. "Mendez, Goldsick, and Swellentrop, attorneys at law." "Thank you," she said distractedly, as a deep sense of foreboding churned in her stomach. She was so distracted by the law firm's letter that it took her a moment to realize that Horatio was still standing in the lobby, staring at her with a strained cheeriness. "Oh, sorry." She reached behind the counter to retrieve a tip for him. "I don't know where my head is today."
"I would like to think it's atop your neck, but looks can be deceiving."
He touched her arm and declared,
"Tea bags, I swear by them,"
before sashaying out the door and onto the mechanic's shop. Mercy knocked on the office door and opened it in time to see her father wake with a surprised snort.
"What's wrong?"
Pop asked her when he saw her drawn face, and she handed him the letter and answer. He took the thick, elegant leaf from the envelope, and his eyebrows lowered as he read. Mercy lingered in the doorway, chipping polish off her fingernails.
"What does it say?"
Roy's lips twisted in distaste before he began reading aloud.
"To Mr. Roy Birdsall, proprietor of Birdsall & Son Undertakers, on behalf of our client, Cunningham's Funeral Services, LLC, we would like to extend to you an offer by the aforementioned for the purchase of Birdsall & Son Undertakers, including property, assets, furniture, supplies, and all goods and services associated herewith."
All the blood drained out of Mercy's face.
"A buyout offer?
As if I'd sell when I'm sure he knows good and well that Zeddy finished school. Cunningham has some nerve."
Her siblings' secrets felt like a ton of bricks on Mercy's shoulders. She'd promised them both that she wouldn't tell Pop what she knew, but in light of Cunningham's offer, it seemed unfair not to tip him off. And yet, if Mercy did spill the beans, would he be tempted to sell? Lil's words hovered over her like a ghost.
"You deserve to live your own life for a change." But selling out to Curtis Cunningham felt like the worst possible outcome.
Everything inside her revolted at the thought. She clamped her lips shut. Pop folded the letter and stuffed it into the envelope.
"I don't want to worry Lillian or Zeddy with this, or make them think that I'm about to pull the rug out from underneath them when there's no cause for alarm. Let's keep this between the two of us for now, all right, Muffin?"
"Sure, Pop."
And with that, she added one more secret to drag at her heels as she returned to the boatworks. She had every intention of working on Mr. Gower's boat, its frame like the bare bones of a body, but all she could think about was the doomed future of Birdsall & Son, and the fact that she very much wanted an answer to that letter she sent last week. She could use a friend. Preferably one who was not a blood relative with a secret. She flipped through the remaining letters in her hands, her scant hopes for the future shriveling as each revealed itself to be either an answer to a death notice or a bill. But then, the last envelope in the stack had the words, "To a friend," written on the front in blocky letters. And Mercy was so glad to see it that she thought she might shoot through the roof and rain down sparkles like a fireworks display. Her fingertips tingled as she opened the envelope and pulled the letter free.
"Dear friend, it would surprise many people to learn that I am, in fact, an excellent dancer. If I ever find you holding up a wall at a party, I promise to dance with you. Not that the opportunity is likely to present itself. As you astutely pointed out,
There is a difference between being lonely and being alone. The good news is that recent developments have lessened the latter, although the jury is out as to whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. While your letter has alleviated the former, thank you for that. Actually, thank you is an understatement, but I'm worried that I'll come across as maudlin if I tell you how grateful I am for your words. What can I say? I needed a friend, and a friend wrote back. You wrote back. I'm glad it was you. Is that maudlin? Honestly, I'm not like this on a day-to-day basis. If anything, the word that best describes me is bristly. So I'll simply say thank you and move on. I'm intrigued by what you said about many people being lonely. It's a sobering thought. Most people seem so dull to me, balloons full of vacuous wind and empty words. I wonder what I would find if I tried to dig deeper every now and again. After all, there are a few things about me that would surprise most people if they ever bothered to scratch the surface. I'm a voracious reader, for one. I suspect many would find it shocking that a man as taciturn as I am would enjoy words so much when they are written on a page. What else? I have a weakness for pie, especially blueberry. I live for tea and despise coffee. Dogs are my favorite people. That last one might not come as a shock to anyone. What would surprise most people about you, I wonder? I think I might be on tenterhooks until I find out. Sincerely, your friend. P.S. Sorry this letter has taken so long to get to you. I live in a remote place and had to wait until I could get to an Imkillum box to post it. You can probably expect similar delays in the future, but I promise I won't stop writing unless you want me to.
Mercy flapped the letter in the air and did a giddy tap dance on the linoleum floor before she read the letter three more times, and then a fourth time for good measure. Who was this bristly, dancing, taciturn reader who lived in a remote place? A rancher? A fisherman? A lighthouse operator? She imagined the sort of man who worked hard and had the lean body and rugged, weather-beaten face to show for it. As this friend took shape in her mind, he began to bear a striking resemblance to Hart Ralston, an image Mercy batted away as quickly as it formed. She reminded herself that her friend could be anyone, and was probably some curmudgeonly hermit with rheumatism who bundled up beside a fire on the warmest of days and played chess against himself. Besides, it didn't matter what he looked like. He was a friend. He was her friend. And she was glad of it. She needed to let Leonard out to do his business, and then she had to finish Mr. Gower's boat and salt and wrap him and seal him in his sloop. She had a million and one things to do before closing up for the day. Instead, she exhumed some paper and a pen from the supply closet and pulled up a stool to the preparation table. "Dear friend," she wrote at the top of the page, in her very best handwriting.
Chapter 7. Halfway up a wooded slope in northwest Tanria, Hart and Duckers watched from the trees as two teens, giggling with inebriety, sheared a wild Tanrian silk sheep on the craggy mountainside. Hart had seen their ilk 100 times, boys who were old enough to think themselves men and young enough to forget how easy it was to die. "This is your typical cut-and-run operation," he instructed Duckers in a low voice. "Smugglers cut a hole in the mist with a pirated portal and pay a few guys to enter the mountains on the border, shear as many sheep as they can pin down, and sell the silk wool on the black market. People are willing to pay an arm and a leg for this stuff, but there's a tariff on the raw material that's legally harvested and processed. Smugglers find guys like this who think it's a lark to bust into Tanria to steal a few bags, usually bored farm kids who know how to handle livestock."
"Okay, so what do we do?"
Duckers had a glint in his eye, game for the adventure, and Hart decided that a sink-or-swim method of teaching his apprentice might be in order here. "You are going to go in there and show them your shiny badge. Then you're going to tell them to leave the silk wool and scram, or you're taking them into custody. I'll be your backup." The glint disappeared from Duckers' eyes,
What? Shouldn't you be the one waving around your badge?
I already know how to wave around my badge. You're the one learning the ropes. Duckers regarded the bleeding blue silk sheep and the drunken teens who were nearly the same age as he was.
Do I have to?
Marshalling isn't all fighting drudges and saving the day. You are now law enforcement, and those twerps are breaking the law.
But I haven't seen a drudge yet.
Hart had already learned not to get drawn into a debate with Duckers. All he had to do was close his mouth and give him a bored look. The kid caved every time.
Fine, Duckers acquiesced with a sucking of his teeth.
You can do this. I'll be right beside you. Go get him. Hart clapped Duckers on the shoulder, the sort of friendly, supportive gesture for which he was not known, but it seemed to give his apprentice the courage he required. Duckers squared his shoulders and approached the teens, with Hart following close behind.
Excuse me, gentlemen, he called,
his voice ringing with authority. Hart thought it was a good start. One of the boys giggled uncontrollably, while the other froze and blanched in the lantern light.
I'm Marshal Duckers of the Tanrian Marshals.
Here, Duckers floundered. An uncomfortable pause galloped between him and the juvenile offenders. He put a shaking hand on the pistol crossbow at his hip and declared,
Put the silk sheep down and I'll let you live.
Salt fucking sea, Hart muttered under his breath, bowing his head and rubbing his fingertip across his forehead so the silk sheep shearers wouldn't see his exasperation. The teens glanced at each other and burst out laughing.
Try again,
Hart coughed.
Go home or we're taking you in,
Duckers told them, but they kept laughing. And, Hart prompted.
And, oh, the silk wool,
Duckers turned to the boys.
And leave the silk wool. Hold on, I've got my license right here,
said the more fearless of the pair. He dug around in his dungarees pocket and pulled out his middle finger, to the cackling amusement of his partner.
Can I shoot them?
Duckers asked his mentor. Hart was pretty sure he was joking, but to be on the safe side, he said unequivocally, No. Duckers tried again.
This is the last time I'm going to say this. Leave the silk wool and go home, or you're under arrest.
The more obnoxious of the pair tugged a flask out of his pocket and took a gulp.
Ooh, I'm so scared. Aren't you shaking in your boots, Gerald?
He handed the flask to his buddy, who nodded and guffawed and took a swig. It was here that Hart noticed a grap moving through the tree branches above the boys. A possessed grap. He picked up a rock from the ground and threw it, knocking the small, frog-like drudge from its perch. It landed on top of Gerald's pestiferous companion, flailing and crying, Rap! In a husky, undead moan.
Get it off! Get it off!
The young man screamed. But Gerald squealed like a terrified pig and made a run for it, leaving his friend to toss the nasty, furry drudge off his head before he pelted after Gerald in terror. The reanimated grap rolled on the ground, got to its feet, and hopped toward Duckers. One of its eyeballs dangled out of its socket by a ligament. Duckers froze in terror as Hart drew his rapier and jabbed it three times, hitting the appendix on the third try. The soul billowed out of the wound, and Hart thought, not for the first time, that a human soul would have to be pretty lost and desperate to possess a half-rotted grap. Then again, who was he to judge? He was lost and desperate with increasing frequency himself. He wiped the blade off on the handkerchief in his pocket and slid it into the sheath before looking at Duckers, whose face was drawn and scared. Well, there's your first drudge. Duckers didn't get the chance to respond, because a rustling in the undergrowth and a low groan made both marshals snap to attention. And there's your second, Hart said, his eyes fastening on a movement to their left. A drudge emerged from between the trees, a woman wearing a torn and filthy homespun dress. Her throat had red puncture wounds from the drudge that had killed her, livid against her lifeless, waxy skin.
Oh, fuck, sir!
Hart had set aside an hour every day for target practice, and Duckers had proven himself a decent shot. He decided to let the kid handle it. "This one is fairly fresh, so it's not going to come after you," he said calmly. "Take out your pistol crossbow."
"Fuck,"
Duckers whimpered. But he did as he was told while Hart came up behind him and began firing off instructions. "Feet shoulder width apart." Hart put his foot between Duckers's and kicked them to the correct width. "You've got the pistol in your right hand with your finger on the trigger. Your left hand's underneath for support. You know what you're doing." He stood at Duckers's back, slowly unholstering his own weapon. "Hold it about chin high. Good. You're aiming for the lower right abdomen."
"Oh,"
the drudge moaned as it shambled closer.
"Fuck."
Sweat poured down the side of Duckers's face. "You know better than anyone where that appendix is," Hart assured his apprentice. "There, fire." Duckers squeezed the trigger. The arrow flew straight and true, and the drudge went down, making an unmoving heap at the base of an aspen.
"Did I get her?"
Duckers asked in a tremulous voice, staying put as Hart went to investigate. "It, not her," Hart corrected him as he examined the corpse. He watched the soul depart the body, and knowing that Duckers couldn't see the amber light, he said, "You got it. First shot. Took me 4 tries my first time."